Turn on the So hello and welcome to another edition of the Carpcast Extra. How are you feeling, Mark?
Oh, feeling fine. I'm feeling fine.
There's about three songs with that line at the start.
I'm feeling fine. I've had a little bit of a turbulent 48 hours.
Turbulent? What, in the bowel area?
How did he guess? It was part of new me, as I do those like little wavy two-fingered asterisks in the air sort of things that nobody can see, so I've just told you about them.
New year, new me.
Yeah, that's the one. Even though it's kind of an ongoing process, and you know, the cold showers and the breathing and everything, I've been, you know, doing a bit of research about gut health and the gut biome, and basically doing everything, trying to do things right so I could be in the best of health and my body operates optimally and I can catch more fish because of it. I got some gut health tablets. And all I can say is the first thing they do is, well, wipe the slate clean. Literally. So I don't want to discuss any of the extra listeners, but also I'll say is it lifted me up off the toilet.
Would you recommend it or not?
I don't know. I'll let you know in another 48 hours and see if things settle down.
I mean, a clean and healthy diet, you know, it's a cliche. You are what you eat.
Of course you are.
Remind me about cliche if I forget in 1 second, actually. But yeah, you are what you eat. And when I did my keto diet for a while, so I was basically not eating carbs, no carbs at all, keeping it under 20 grams a day, I think, to put your body into ketosis. Was generally eating healthy stuff. You allowed fat and little fat bombs to keep your energy up, and I developed a taste for coffee. But I tell you what, I didn't half feel good. I kept it up for 2 weeks, and I felt I felt fresh, I felt alert, I felt awake. It's very hard to maintain healthy eating on the bank, isn't it? You know, the couple of times I've done quite a bit of fishing this autumn, winter, and that's when I broke the diet, because you know, I've got into a routine of the food that I take fishing. You know, it's easy, you buy your curries and it's easy to do the rice, or you have your bacon barm cakes or rolls or whatever you call them, perhaps in the mornings. So kind of get a routine of fishing food, because it's not easy to get creative on the bank. If it goes in a ridge monkey, it gets cooked and thrown in some bread of some description, and you know, some sort of Indian type curry in the evenings for me, occasionally steak and mash or something like that, generally sausages. But it's quite hard to maintain a keto or no carb diet while you're fishing. But I tell you what, fishing would benefit from it. You know, you're going to have that energy to get up in the mornings, you know, make sure you're looking properly, just awake and alert. It's got to be a good thing for all assets of your life, but definitely for the fishing.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it saves, you've got half an hour of light left, the wind's just changed, and the fish are boshing down the other end of the lake. You know, I can 100% say if it happened to me last year, I'd just think, oh, Sodom, they might be back tomorrow, I'm not moving now. Whereas if I look in the past, you know, like, I remember I moved it through the night on St. Ives a few times. And I've got that energy back. You know, I'll be daft enough to be doing it again. You know, drop of the hat, I'm off. You know, I won't be able to sit knowing the fish are elsewhere. So yeah, I'm genuinely looking forward to this this season. You know, it's again the cliche, the new me.
Somebody asked a question today. Make a good listener's question on the normal podcast.
Yeah.
But I'm going to have to get a jingle done. Cliche carpers. They basically asked me, "Is you know, what's this stereotypical carper look like?" And it just made me think of cliche carpers. So I think we're going to have to get a new feature for the normal podcast. Cliche carper.
Cliche carpers.
Bucket hat, camo, Terry Hearn hairstyle. You know, long curtains, long hair with curtains.
He's got to be a field tester as well.
Yeah, yeah.
The bait company nobody's ever heard of.
Yeah, can you think of any other cliches? I mean, it's the knitted woolly jumper these days, isn't it?
Yeah, does he fold his handles and fish flat lines?
Definitely. That no, that's a cliche carper for sure.
Catches perch in the winter.
Yeah.
This is basically carp aren't sheep recycled.
cliche carpers is carp are not sheep, isn't it? We haven't done a carp are not sheep for a little while, so we'll have to get that back in the normal episode. Moving on with this one, what are the questions we're asking our special guest this time?
I think this is something that everyone is going to be related to, the sacrifices that have been made in our pursuit of carp. And what have influenced, or what people have influenced us that have... lit the fire, as Chilly would say.
Light the fire, yeah. Well, if we do sacrifices first, I mean, I know I've made plenty of sacrifices, mainly in my personal life, to be able to go fishing. You know, whether it be I can't afford to go 1 week and I'm going to leave myself in trouble financially if I go fishing and I just go. I've sacrificed time with my daughter when she was young. Not proud of it. Would probably not do that again. I'd listening to a podcast as a guy that I heard interviewed had a very interesting philosophy on life. So he's saying he was talking about, you know, he's separated from his missus. This guy's a billionaire. He's a hedge fund manager, former oil trader. Started with nothing. He wasn't sort of born into it. He decided he wanted to do it. A little bit like, have you seen the film Pursuit of Happiness with Will Smith?
I've not seen that one, no.
That's a really good film, actually. But yeah, quite similar story to him. Just an intelligent guy, you know, started working the shop floor, literally being the tea man, you know, the dog's body, because he realised he wanted to work in that business, so much money was into it. And he's now a billionaire. But he enjoys his life. He's got a philosophy that you know, we work to buy the money we earn when we work is to buy other people's time. So time is the most important thing. It's the most precious thing we have as a human being, because we have a finite amount of it on this earth. And you know, the things that you can maybe do now at 40 years old, you're not gonna be able to do at 90. So you can rule those years out if you make it. You know, if you want to be a skier, you know, you want to be climbing trees, searching after carp, you're not going to be doing it at 85 years old. So there's a finite amount of time. So if you think, okay, I'm 40 years old now, and I think health wise, you know, I want to go fishing, I want to do 30 nights a year, and I think I'm still going to be doing it for another 15 years. Well, you've actually only got 15 times 30. That's the amount of nights you're going to fish for the rest of your life, most likely. So I'm just using fishing as an example. So you need to make them count, because you haven't actually got many. And vice versa, he's saying, you know, if you're, you know, you've got a child, your child's 8 years old. This is a position I was in when I was sort of got really keen with traveling down to Elstow and stuff. The amount of weekends I missed spending with my daughter. When she's 16, she don't want to spend time with her dad anymore. She can be off with her mates, you know, she can be at university, she's going to be at college. So you've literally got, you know, if she was, say, let's say she was 10 years old, I've got 6 years left, right? That's 52 weekends a year. If I fish 25 weekends a year, I've only got 6 years of 25 weekends left with my daughter. That's 140, 145 weekends I've got left. They're precious. We need to not waste them. Because there is a finite amount, and when it comes to time, it's a very finite thing. So he's saying, like, if you want to go fishing, say fishing costs you £100 a week, and you know, you work out you're going to have 150 more fishing sessions in your life, you need X amount of money to be able to do that. And if you get obsessed over work, some people, you know, they're doing every minute of it. This doesn't apply to me and you, Mark, because we both try and, you know, you've reduced your work to get a quality of life, haven't you? And, you know, I made that choice many years ago. But there's a lot of people out there working themselves into the ground. They're doing overtime just because it's there. And they're missing that time with the family, with their daughter. They might be missing fishing time. And for what? You're buying time from somebody else. So, like, you need your teeth fixing, you buy your dentist time, right? So you're working to earn enough money to buy the dentist time to be able to get your teeth done. Once your teeth are done, you don't need to work for the dentist time. Once you've got enough money at your peak net worth to fish those 150 sessions for the rest of your life, you know, maybe you want to go on holiday twice a year and it's going to cost £2,000 per holiday. So that's £4,000 a year. Once you've got enough to do those things, anything else, you're wasting time, because you don't die. Like, any money you die with is wasted time. This is his general point. So if you have any more than what you actually need to do the things that you want to do, you've wasted a finite amount of your life, like chasing something that you don't even need. It's all about quality of life, but I think he actually has a calculator to work it out. It works out your net worth, you know, how long you're going to be active for based on your current health and you know, and the natural age that you're going to live to, the type of recreations you want to do. You know, if you're a chess player, you could probably still can be doing it at 81 years old if you live that long. Whereas, you know, if you're a downhill slalom skier, you're probably not going to be doing it at 81 years old. So it all depends on the things that make you happy. But I've taken, maybe it's easy to say because I'm 43, 44 now, but I've definitely wasted time pursuing things that maybe not that important now. And I think fishing people can get sucked into, work can get sucked into, you know, all that saving for a rainy day is literally wasted life, because it is pointless. So
yeah, I've got to wonder how much time did this fellow waste coming up with the equations.
Well, yeah,
but now he has some great points there. I mean, I think back on my existence, I could have I wasted a lot of time getting drunk and going to heavy metal gigs and chasing carp.
Yeah, but
you know what? I would do exactly the same again, because I enjoyed every second of it. It's the work that I haven't done. I consider that a waste of time, but it is a necessary evil to
that's exactly fund everything else. That's exactly what he's saying. He's saying it's the work that you're wasting the time. He said, because when you get to 70 years old, 80 years old, the only things you're left with, you can't do anything with the money. You know, you can't spend it on a skiing holiday if you can't go skiing. He said the only thing you have, the things that you're buying with your money, are memories, experiences, and because they're all that you have when you're older, you know, the experiences with your family, with your children, on holidays, you know, holding the lady up, you know, chasing carp, climbing trees, whatever, they're all experiences. And you need to balance them, obviously, if all your experiences are fishing and you miss out on all the family stuff, or, you know, miss your kids growing up or whatever, then that's a bad thing. But generally, you want to have all the experiences, because they're the only things that you have when you get old. Your money's no use to you when your health's gone. So, you know, it's your memories. You're creating memories, and you're buying that with the time. You're buying other people's time. You know, you're buying the ski instructor's time. You're buying, you know, to get the enjoyment you want out of skiing, and you take lessons. You're working to pay for the time of somebody else to teach you to do something that's going to help you create those memories, or you get the general point. I mean, it's there's obviously a balance to be had, as in everything, but you know, there's so many people stuck in jobs that they just don't want to be doing. And quite often, you know, they're taking overtime because it's there and they don't know when it'll be there again. And, you know, they're stashing this money. And I don't know, I think you can go, there's a balance. This is the general point, is that there is a perfect balance. And he's got software to work it out, you know, depending on what you want to do for the rest of your life. You want to have two holidays a year. It may be that you can sustain the life that you want by working 20 hours a week instead of 60. because you don't really need the rest. So, you know, depending on what it is that makes you happy, you know, the life experiences you want to lead. But anyway, yeah, that was a little bit of a random one for the start of this. But sacrifices. So, can you think of any obvious sacrifices?
Well, personally, I've sacrificed quite a bit for fishing, but it's not something that's coincidence. It's usually my overdraft. But then again, I do exactly the same. It gets paid off once a month, and then you get a month to smash it again. You know, I regret paying the bank all those fees and then not claiming them back when everyone else was, and I missed that boat. But no, I've done this quite a few times. I'm not a sort of person. I don't do regrets. You know, you make your decisions, you do your stuff, and you can't change it. You stand by it, or you learn. So, sacrifices, but
let's have a listen to someone else's sacrifices, and
biggest sacrifices I've made for carp fishing. Blimey. Sorry, my wife just said something. Say that again. Oh, well, yeah. I don't know about relationships, because I didn't seriously get into carp fishing until I met Lynn, really. You know, like full level, I want to go every week kind of thing. And Lynn has been so supportive in all of it. The biggest sacrifices I've ever made. I'm going to say something now, and this is a little bit, I don't know, it's not controversial, but it obviously means something to me. I mean, the biggest sacrifices I ever made that were actually probably needless was Echo. And the time and the effort that I spent doing it. And people will, unless I wrote a book about it, I did mention Echo very, very briefly at the end of Light My Fire. I didn't want to cloud any of those stories with any political agenda. But its zenith, we had about 2,400 members. And I'm not going to mention the one or two other people. They know how much I appreciated what they did. Indeed, one of them really took it over in the end. But in an effort, its influence is still around today. People do take notice. People stock lakes differently now. I think we did stem to a massive extent the amount of carp being stolen from abroad, most of which die in transit, and the few that get here kill countless carp, more than anything else has ever killed carp with those illegal fish. But it's how little the masses of people who go carp fishing cared. Most people just care about catching a big fish. And I think that's a little bit sad, you know. I think you should care. You know, I could name right now a whole host of waters that are stocked with illegal carp. I won't do that, of course, but you know, people fishing to this day, they don't care. They, you know, in that time I was doing Echo, they turned their back on it. They didn't. All they wanted was to catch a big fish. And if you don't have respect for the fish we're angling for, then I don't think you should be angling, is my honest opinion. But for me, that was it. It was the biggest struggle I'd ever been involved with. You know, I got thrown out of Westminster a couple of times. They really didn't like it, but at the time, I was the ideal man to do it. They were quite prepared to accept somebody who would just have a little word with them and a little bit of a shout and a holler. But nowadays, you probably wouldn't get away with it. But was it worth it? Nah, not in the slightest, because people don't care.
It's a shame to hear Chilly say that he kind of regrets the time that he spent on Echo. You got any sort of comments on that?
Yeah, it did. While I was recording with Ian, it did surprise me, all that. I mean, I thought they, you know, they didn't get the end goal, but they did achieve quite a lot. You know, they had got meetings at government level. you know, that that takes some doing. And no, I think surely yeah, they should be proud of what they did with Echo, what they achieved. They certainly highlighted the problem with disease coming with illegally imported fish, and no, I think Tillis would take a bow.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame that he thinks it was wasted. I think maybe he feels like he was beating a you know, fighting a losing battle, because obviously we know now, I mean, illegal imports, I think everybody knows they're bad, and you know, there are enough illegal foreign imports these days, and obviously there can still be problems with that. They've got to be quarantined properly, you know, the likes of KHV and stuff. But I think the way it was a bit of a, I think it was a little bit of a keep it real battle in the early days. There was like a bit of a fight about the inevitable that was happening anyway. And really, if we go back, a lot of the carp were foreign anyway. You know, a lot of these, the you know, the Dick Walker, the Redmire fish, a lot of the early stockings were all from abroad anyway. So, you know, without going too far into the sort of fish argument of what's credible and what isn't, and without going down that road, maybe he was fighting a battle he couldn't win. Fighting a battle with no end, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think you're quite possible there, although it's not just, you know, foreign fish, because I do think the, well, all carp are foreign. I just think it's a void argument. It just holds no weight. Of course we are. You know, humans are foreign, to be honest. And I think I said before on the main carp cast, the, you know, Britain, it's just full of mongrels from all over the planet and, you know, mixed breeding with each other. But now for the carp, it was more of the venues like, you remember Darenth and then Ringstead, you know, they were stocked with, you know, ridiculously big, almost record sized imports.
Yeah,
which did kind of take away the they didn't have any credibility, to be honest.
And a number of others, you know, without naming and shaming, but I'm looking at pictures now, recently, looking at sort of classic pictures. People are posting up old pictures from some well-known lakes that denied, you know, lakes that had bigger than average fishing, you know, in the 80s and 90s, and, you know, but denied that they were imported, because they certainly weren't legally imported, which means they were stolen. You know, from lakes like Shanticock and stuff. And when you look at them now compared to, you know, fish that we know their origins of, you can just see a mile away that 100% they were, you know, stolen fish from abroad. And, you know, some very well-known people owning these lakes, I'm not here to name and shame and stuff, but we were quite ignorant then. It was just like, we didn't know as much about carp and the different strains and stuff as what we do now. You know, I can look at a picture of a carp in Carp Talk or whatever, and I know where it's from. Not the fish itself, but the strain. You know, you might narrow it down to a few lakes rather than pick the exact lake, but, you know, oh, that's one of the Colne Valley fish, or, you know, I think a lot of those came from across the water back in the day as well.
I saw a picture recently. It was, you know, a mid-40, and I believe a headline along it. I'm sure people are going to know what I'm talking about. The headline next to this fish was something like, you know, mysteries are out there, or myths are still out there, which I looked at the fish and it did make me smile, because they're not mysteries. I know exactly where they live, and up until a certain foot of mouth outbreak, it was a fishery and, you know, a syndicate, quite a well-known one as well. It's just extremely limited access since then. They're not unknown fish, but it's nice to romanticise about that sort of thing. But getting back to the different strains, it's the Dink strain, and no, you know it anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, and especially like you say, the Shanticoke fish, they're quite specific to that lake and that region, aren't they? And, you know, when they show up in England, you know, especially in some of these classic lakes that denied it, you know, back in the day. But people didn't know any different then, in the fact of, we didn't know enough to be able to argue that, you know, 100%. It's like, it's almost the equivalent of, you have three shops, you have Sainsbury's, Co-op and Tesco's, and the shopping comes out in a Sainsbury's bag, a Tesco's bag or a Co-op bag, and it's like selling the same produce in the Tesco's bag in Aldi and trying to say that it didn't come from Tesco's, Aldi have had it all along. It's literally that black and white, you know. It's like, well, no, it's in Tesco's bag. Yeah, but you know, there's loads of them Tesco's bags about. Well, we now know that there isn't. There's only one Tesco's. There isn't 10 different ones, and it could have come from anywhere. We know Tesco's is Tesco's, Aldi is Aldi, and it's literally that black and white with certain strains of fish, and certain strains are unique to an area, and they just don't, unless they've been moved, they, you know, they don't appear in other areas, you know, especially England, when it's a very well-known foreign area.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can look now, and how many fish do you see in Carp Talk? I mean, every single week, and you think, that's a simo, that's a simo, that's a simo.
Exactly. So if you imagine, sort of you know, in Bulgaria or somewhere that have never had a simo, if they all started, you know, if they didn't have big fish and all of a sudden these simo started tipping up there, everyone would know they'd been robbed from England if they weren't legally bought. Obviously, if they're legally bought, then there's papers. But, you know, trying to make out these big fish that got massive humpy backs, like the big sort of shantycock fish with the big hoover mouths and the humpy backs, and there's no documentation, trying to make out that this fish had lived in this lake all its life, it's just been caught, like, which is kind of what went on in the 80s and 90s. Like, it's just so... Getting back to the point, you know, Chile, I think Chile was right to highlight this, certainly for the illegal, you know, the and... You know, Chile and many people like him were clued up, you know, in that time. They were privy to information that, you know, the masses weren't. You know, they knew of these people that were actually doing the smuggling and stuff. And even though a lot of these people weren't outed, and some of them were quite famous anglers at the time, like you say, they always turned up in lakes either owned by or best mates of somebody that was, you know, a high profile foreign angler as well. Like, it, you know, it was never somebody, you know, these big shantycock type looking fish never turned up in a lake with a guy that had never left the country. You know, they never just miraculously appeared. They're always people that were synonymous with France in the early days. So, but anyway, moving on. It's a shame Chile feels bad. I think he did a great thing highlighting it. Like I say, it was probably a losing battle, and the lines are so blurred these days, but. I don't think it was wasted time at all. You know, there's government bodies that now take note, as you said. So, yeah, moving on.
Sacrifices I've made for carping, relationships, jobs, etc. Well, this could be quite a lengthy answer. I suppose, have we not all balls things up over the years in pursuit of fish? I remember... I think it was the first... I've drifted in and out of carp fishing over the years. I've fished for nothing else but carp probably since I was 14, and I'm sort of 45, and I've drifted out of it in different phases: football, motorbikes, women, drugs, back into motorbikes, back into drinking, back into women. But I'd got really back into my carp fish. I'd moved out of home, and I was renting this lovely little cottage with a really fit bird named Sam. And she had massive bangers, which was a main asset, but she had mega, mega chesticles. Right, and she was fit. Don't know how I pulled her. I haven't got a clue. But she was lovely. And we moved into this cottage, and I was working at a co-op in a warehouse. It was probably about 96, 97. In fact, it was 96. I remember we used to go out and watch the football, Euro 96. And I was fishing... a lake. I used to get a Tuesday off. I used to have to work Saturdays, I get a Tuesday off. But I was pushing it with the fishing. I was fishing a place called Cat and Park, which it's a sin, it used to be day ticket. And eventually, she just wouldn't stand for it anymore, basically. I was getting more and more. So, obviously, I finished work Saturday on noon at 2 o'clock, straight off fishing till Sunday night. My day off on a Tuesday, straight up to Cat, and I was coming home, and I was obviously knackered because I'd been fishing all day. She just got bit bored of it, and I think she just must have looked in the mirror and thought, look at me, look at these bangers, and look at this knob. I'm getting out with somebody that doesn't pay me any attention, doesn't give me any time, doesn't take me out anymore, and just goes fishing. And so bad, so I think I'd come home from work one day and she'd gone. And to be honest, I wasn't that bothered. There was another one named Katie, and I was into me fishing massively. It was the horseshoe linear days, and I couldn't get enough of it. But come winter, it was too muddy,
couldn't be arsed, not for too long, so I'm back out on town. And I met her through a friend of a friend of a friend. She's from Halifax. She's a lovely girl. She hadn't got massive bangers. She got quite little bangers, but she was quite filthy. Again, don't know how I pulled her, but she was quite nice. So we were getting on quite well. I think she thought I was a bit of a rogue. I don't know why. I thought I was going through a phase that I probably don't really want to talk about that much. But anyway, so I was going up to Halifax, taking the lads up there. She was coming down here, and you know, it was all good. Until we come to like the end of February, and I'm thinking, nights are drawing out a bit now. I need to be getting my arse back down linear. So you know when you sort of fish around for an argument with a bird, just for an excuse, so you can have an argument, so you can say, tell you what, just forget it. It's not you, it's me. Come out with all the cheesy lines that makes it a bit more bearable, the fact that you really want to dump it because mid-March is coming, you know the fish will be up for a zig on St. John's, and you really want to go fishing and don't want the, you know, you don't want the embarrassment of saying, look, Katie Fitbird from Halifax to the Little Tits, I'd rather go fishing than be with you, because that's really what I'm into. So I made this massive, like, storm out of a teacup, but a massive argument. So she storms off, had to sleep in a hotel, because obviously she's supposed to be sleeping at my house, because she's from Halifax. So I did the really gentlemanly thing, and I manned up, and I texted her the following day and said, it's not working, it's you, it's me, I don't think I'm ready for a relationship. Put my gear in the old Peugeot and headed straight off down to Linney for three nights, and I've not seen her since. That was about 18 years, about 10, 12 years ago, whatever it was. But I'm very lucky that I've got my Mrs. Cathy. I've been with her a long time, and she's very, very independent, and she's only ever known me to fish. She's and my God, she has brought some shit from me, Mark, honestly. She really has. Not in that I'm a bad person, but carp fishing is an obsessive, selfish hobby. And I think anybody that's relatively successful at it who says they aren't selfish to a certain degree is a liar. Because with carp fishing, you feel yourself getting better. And the better you get and the more you understand what you're doing, the more you want to go when you want to put it into practice. And, you know, I've got no kids. And I even go back to the days when me and Cathy got together, when I was working for Armalad, and Tony used to say to me in jail, right, you can work 3 days a week. If you get your work done in three, you can piss off fishing. Happy days. So I'd work my balls off for 3 days up and down the country, go to Lynch on a Thursday, come back on a Sunday. And bearing in mind, I'm staying away from home from Monday to Wednesday, because it's just more cost effective to stay in a hotel than drive all over the place. And Cathy never said a word, ever. And then obviously I got my job at Tracker, and I was working 4 days a week. So straight from work on a Thursday, so I'd be out all week. I'd see her like, you know, on a Sunday when I'm back from Welly. I was just so obsessive with what I wanted from fishing. However, she stuck with me. I don't know. She must have seen something in me that at times I can't see, because I'm not so bad now. You know, I'm older and I'm wiser, and getting a good balance, I think, is the key to being a happier angler. Not necessarily as successful or as productive as I possibly have been in the past, but I'm in a better place for the fact that I've got a balance with my home life, that I think I'm a better person and more considerate, certainly to Cathy's feelings, because, you know, I wasn't in the early days. And that ashames me. I'm actually ashamed of the person I used to be. When I look at some of the things I did, and all that mattered was me getting carp fishing, whether it was at Lynch or at Welly or at Finlay, that was all that mattered. You know, and I'm not proud of the person or some of the things that I did. And I think, you know, I owe Cathy the respect and the sort of admiration for sticking by me through them years, and to the point now where I enjoy my time with her a lot more, because I've got the balance of whether it's doing other things outside of carp fishing that keeps me level-headed and keeps me balanced. Because I meet a lot of people on the bank, and this isn't a dig at anybody in particular, and it's been raised before on the Carpcast, that a lot of people I meet, because maybe of marijuana abuse, they've got no social skills because they've done too much time on the bank, they've become reclusive, they don't know how to live outside of being in a bivvy or being on their own all the time. You know, they just become a bit of a hermit. And I think it depends what you want from your fishing. You know, do you want to be have a good balance in your life, and do you want to still enjoy your fishing for what it's supposed to be? Do you want to take it to the next level and risk being single or living in a substandard standard, if you like, or being at home? I remember Picky, you know, Martin Pickley, we know both very well. He's a lovely guy. And I remember him writing an article in Cartwheels years ago about the truth about him. And basically, he's a fantastic angler, but he'd done too much time on the bank, and he got no girlfriend, he got no job, he was a heavy weed smoker, and he lived in a bedroom at his mum's house, and he was mid-30s. And he woke up one day and realised that he got nothing in his life other than an album of fantastically big fish. And it suddenly didn't mean that much to him. And now he still goes fishing. I think he's got a missus. He follows Leicester City all over the country. He's got a job. So he's got such a good balance now. And I think he's in a happier place. So I think the personal sort of sacrifices that I've made is that it took me a lot of years to realise that you can still have enjoyment from your fishing whilst maintaining a very good home life and having a good close circle of friends around you, because it's the best job and it's the best pastime in the world if you get a good balance. If you let it totally ruin you and take over your life, it can just do that. It can ruin your passion for fishing and your urge to go out and go fishing. So there's several sacrifices I've made, and a lot of them I am proud of, but hopefully I've righted the demon, certainly with my own life and with some of my close friends. And I think a lot of the people that I talk to and consider close friends, you know, like Ian Russell, for example, we have a very balanced life outside of fishing. We have a very stable life. We try and be good people and do good things. And I think it's karma paying you back in the long run.
I'm sure a common theme for a lot of people is sacrificing time at home with a loved one or not so loved one, just like Ian.
What did you say? Pictured bird from Halifax.
How many times have you fobbed a woman off for fishing? I don't know. Your missus doesn't let you. Your missus tells you when you can go fishing, so it's probably not a good one for you.
Yeah, I'll be honest. Kerry is spot on. She lets me pretty much. That's probably why I've lasted so long, because we've both got our own space.
She's done it very well, because she's let you think that you're allowed to go fishing where you want. She's done a great job.
She's absolutely. Yeah, she told me to go fishing to get out of the way.
Yeah, I've. Something I want to speak about in the book a little bit, but I wasn't sure how far to go down the debaucherous lifestyle I may or may not allegedly have experienced.
I've put the word allegedly at the start and then just tell all.
But you know, I had a pretty good setup for a few years. It definitely cost me a relationship. I mean, it was a relationship that needed to end, because it was we're two different people, so it might have done us a favour. Everything normally works out the way it's meant to, I think. And I'm not saying it's fate, or I'm, you know, a believer in mumbo jumbo or anything, but generally if something's bad or not meant to be, it finds a way of not being, I think. But my daughter's mother, we were never meant to be together, you know, it was accidental. We weren't together when she had the baby. We tried to make a go of it for a year, just two different people, never ever in love. You know, and after a little bit of a messy breakup, like, because they always are when you break up, but once we got that out of the way, because we were never in love and there was no deep emotions, like, it was a pretty good relationship to this day. You know, she's had her new fellas mend my car, and, you know, one of them was a plumber who fitted a bathroom for me, and, you know, there's no malice or anything at all. But the fishing, definitely, when I was talking in the previous extra about joining the wire and all of a sudden meeting people who are more serious about fishing than I'd ever thought possible, and I got addicted to it, and I was fishing literally seven nights a week. It was in the winter, I wasn't DJing much, and my summer job in Blackpool had finished until Easter, and I was doing one night a week, Sunday nights, at a place in Preston. So I was DJing, I was fishing six nights a week. I was coming home for a shower on the Sunday, to get ready for the gig. My gear was in the motor. I would drive and do the gig and then drive straight and set up on the lake again at 3 o'clock in the morning, all the way through winter, November, December, January. I was doing 7 nights a week on the bank. And that was kind of the catalyst to splitting up with him, to splitting up. Although, like I say, it was a good thing that that happened. It was definitely fishing that did it, you know, that was kind of caused the rows. But I didn't want to be anywhere else. That's where I wanted to be. And I caught two fish in 60 nights over the winter, and one at the start of winter in November, and one at the end of winter in end of Feb. Absolutely nothing through the hardcore. I enjoyed being there, you know. I loved every minute of it. But the fishing probably engineered a relationship breakup. I don't know. I'm sure it's a common theme of losing girlfriends over fishing. I remember a few arguments in the past, like even before that when I was younger, like 20, 21 stuff. Girls getting the hump with me, fishing a lot. But anyway, let's move on. Have you ever had an occasion where fishing ruined your life? Maybe, you know, you got so obsessed you lost a job, or, you know, the wife ran off with a milkman, or is there any way that carp obsessions took over?
Yeah, well, I've been quite lucky, really. I mean, my first wife, she's not my ex-wife because anything to do with fishing, because, you know, I look back at, I mean, I was married to her for 28 years, and I look back at it now and think, what a good woman she was, you know, because she never nagged me about me fishing or anything like that. Let me get on with it, you know, and though she used to nag me at the time, you know, put fishing before everything. I think you can look back on these things and see how selfish you were, you know. But the same consolation, you had to do it. When you're so obsessed with carp fishing or something else, you've got to do it, haven't you? You know, and everything else comes second. But I didn't actually lose any... I didn't lose my relationship with her because of anything to do with fishing. You know, we'd just been married for 28 years and you know, I think sometimes relationships, you know, they go a bit stale, you know. But no, I nearly lost my life, however... Wow. Over carp fishing once. But as far as jobs and that, no, I gained a job because of carp fishing, and so, you know, which I'm forever indebted to Gary and Kevin Pleat, you know, the tackle box, who offered me that opportunity all them years ago. But no, I very nearly lost my life because of fishing once, and that wasn't on Connie, but it was on Whippy Pool when Kevin Maddox first got hold of it. He invited myself, Alan Partridge and Rob Malin for a weekend fishing on there, and we went down there, and it was ever so snaggy, you know. I mean, to the point, you know, when he first got hold of it, to the point that you very often you didn't even get your end tackle in, you know.
Yeah.
And in them days we didn't use to fill our lead down, so you weren't nowadays, putting your lead down, you might know it's a snag or something like that, but at the time you didn't, you cast it. And back in them days, I was always the one who volunteered. So if anyone had a fish weeded up or something, like, I was always the one to volunteer and strip down to my underpants and dive in and try and get it, you know. And I was round in the corner of the lake, you know, sort of stalking or something. Rob Mayden's come running around. He said, Alan's got a fish on, and he said it snagged him, wants to know if you're going for it. And bear in mind, it was like October time anyway, so it wasn't warm. Fortunately, I was, you know, so I'll come around in a minute, and fortunately, I was, you know, quite a fit bloke then. You know, I used to work as a dustman and had done for a number of years, so I was lugging around big metal bins and things like that, and a good swimmer as well. So I went round. And Alan said, well, he's right in the middle of the lake, his eyes are bite, and it snagged me virtually straight away. So I felt the fish, and so I stripped down to the underpants, dived in the lake, and I'm swimming out to the middle, which was about 70, 80 yards away, and you know, following his line, I got to the point where the line went down, and I'm going underneath the water, and I couldn't get anywhere near the bottom. And I thought, I don't know what I'm supposed to do here, and if I can't touch, you know, and anyway, the line is lying around my arm and sort of tried to ease it up. All of a sudden the line broke and I waved at Alan, you know, back at the bank and said, I lost it, it's gone. You know, and then I turned around to swim back to the lake and everything seized up. My arms, my legs and everything.
Wow.
Everything seized up and it was as much as I could do to swing my arms around of a coin to get back to the bank. And if it weren't for the fact that I was fit, I wouldn't have made it. I would have drowned. You know, no doubt about it. I got back to the bank, immediately collapsed onto the bank, in which case they was all taking the piss and everything. But you know, they threw a towel over me, lifted me onto a bed chair, and I couldn't move off the bed chair. You know, everything. So from that point on, I swore blind I would never go into a lake again unless I knew I could touch the bottom. You know.
Wow.
Yeah, because carp fishing not worth your life, you know. And So very rarely we weren't here to have this conversation.
Wow.
But, you know, but I'm sure if nowadays if the same thing happened, I would definitely be dead. You know, because I'm nowhere near as fit as I used to be.
Well, we're glad you're still here. We're definitely glad you're still here.
Well, I suppose really since an early age, everything has sort of revolved around fishing, you know, so it's had to sort of fit in with fishing in one way or another, you know, and that's, of course, well, all of life, including jobs, relationships, where I've lived, cars I've bought, you know, everything centres around fishing. So, yeah, there's certainly a few relationships gone the wrong way. I mean, there was a period, I suppose, when I was about 18, getting towards 20, where I'd stopped fishing for a couple of years. You know, like you do, you discover friends and pubs and girls and all that. And so I got settled down with this girl. And then, you know, once you get settled down, you start thinking of things. And I thought, well, I don't know, you know, I need to get the rods out and go fishing. And of course, once I did that, you know, everything come flooding back, and she wondered what the hell was going on. You know, what on earth was up with me? You know, I was this bloke she was going out with every weekend down the pub, and all of a sudden I was just disappearing, and she couldn't work out what was going on at all. So that certainly didn't last much longer. Anyway, she soon got the hump with that. As did, you know, two or three after that. It is a killer for relationships, fishing, there's no doubt about it, especially carp fishing. And I suppose you have to be quite selfish, you know, as carp anglers, we are quite selfish. We demand a lot of time to do what we do. And that goes for jobs as well. You know, there's so many jobs where in the past, you know, I've had time off, taking sickies and wangled everything I could just to spend a few more hours on the bank, and they get the ump with you as well because you're not dedicated to the job. You know, fishing was my dedication, and going to work was just a means of paying bills and going fishing. So, you know, there's a lot of things that sort of went down the pan, I suppose, because of fishing. And, you know, nothing's changed in that respect. But the good thing is now, you know, I'm working more in fishing, that my drive and determination to do more fishing helps the work. You know, it gives me more work. It pleases, you know, the governor's well happy now. I want to do more fishing. You know, it's exactly what he wants. So, I suppose... the moral is, you know, if you're that determined to do something, go and do it, and somehow it'll find a way to work itself out, which it has done. You know, I've got a partner in Joan that loves fishing as much as I do, and she wants to spend all, you know, the time fishing with me. I've got a job I love in fishing, and the people who employ me love me going fishing, so that's perfect. So, you know, If you stick at it long enough and work hard enough, there's a good outcome in everything, I suppose. It doesn't all have to go wrong. So, yeah, there's, you know, well, you get out of it what you put in. It's that old saying, but it's so true, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, I doubt. You know, everything you've just said there, I can relate to. I mean, I remember going through a time of, like, applying for jobs, because the one I had was just, you know, the company was struggling and wasn't going to last much longer. And I was specifically looking for jobs that were 3-on-3-off or 4-on-4-off, where I could get a good session in between and...
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah, you do. You know, that's what you do as an angler, isn't it? You don't particularly look for a job that's going to give you loads of overtime or, you know, good prospects. Oh, you
keep look overtime. For something
that's going to suit your fishing. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Who needs that? Yeah. That's the last thing you want, isn't it?
Yeah, unless overtime is fishing. But I remember one job I was in as a fella. He got called up into the office, and he got a written warning. Because the manager, he had his sick days out and a list of all the race meetings, and they all tallied up. He was into his racing, and I'm thinking, I hope he doesn't look at my sick days in the weather report, because he'll see every time there's a pressure drop in a southwesterly, I've knocked sick.
Oh yeah, oh, you know, I can relate to that one. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, everything, you know. Look, like, you know, bank holidays and things like that. I mean, they don't mean anything to me now because I sort of work from home or I'm out fishing. But, you know, bank holidays, I used to sort of try and take 4 days of my holiday to make it a week and make that a week session and things like that. You know, everything was trying to just maximise my fishing time however I could.
Yeah. Yeah, I've done.
But, yeah.
Done exactly the same all my life, and now we've, you know, got to a stage, it's you know, trying to make you know, something to do with fishing, you know, the work, you know, through, you know, trying to bring this podcast up, which is, it's as fun as much as ours. Yeah. You know, it's, you know, still work in a fishing shop 40 hours a week, and yeah, like you say, it's just do what you enjoy, not what you know, just some mundane 9-to-5 job that you hate.
Yeah, and I've done loads of those in the past, yeah, in the younger days. You know, it was a case. Yeah, I suppose most of us do in the early days. You know, I never really sort of knew what I wanted to do. You know, I never imagined fishing being a job. Yeah. And there was things I sort of enjoyed, but the jobs, you know, just, oh God, they were just something I had to do. I couldn't wait to get out of them.
Yeah, and then, well, as long as I had enough money for bait and fuel in my van. You know, it was just, you know, a crap job, and I'd just daydream about fishing to get through the day.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose it makes you appreciate the fishing, you know, when I was working 5 days a week, and yeah, I mean, but I mean, people keep telling me how lucky I am these days. Well, I am lucky, but then you do make your own luck, you know. I never woke up, never won the lottery and got it, you know. It was a long road, a lot of years to get to where I am now, but you know, it's a happy working life I've got now.
Yeah, and,
never thought I'd say that, but
yeah, it's a position you've earned as well, so yeah, you know, fair play.
Yeah, it does. Well, yeah. It's like, say, if you want something enough, it's there. It depends how much you want it, I suppose, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Not anything.
Yeah, definitely, and. And you mentioned there your wife Joan. She's a wonderful woman as well, and I've got a wonderful woman myself downstairs, and she doesn't want to come fishing with me, but doesn't mind me swanning off. So I'm lucky in that respect.
Yeah, that's so important. Oh yeah, they don't have to be there. I mean, there's times, to be honest, when I'd like to get out with me mates. You know, it's one thing that I miss out on a lot of the time. But if you've got someone who sort of trust you and supports you in what you're doing like that, then that's brilliant, isn't it? You know, you can't ask for more than that. It just makes for a happy life, doesn't it?
Yeah, oh, definitely. She lets me know when I start taking the piss a bit with it, but which does happen more than what she'd like.
Yeah, well, they all do that, don't they?
Yeah. It gives me that balance, which is a good thing.
Yeah. No, I mean, they all let you know when you're doing something wrong. I've found that out over the years.
Yeah, I've kind of got over the target fish obsession point now to just enjoying all aspects of it.
Well, it does get hold of you, that side of things. I know when I was on the Mia, I mean, especially towards the end when I knew I was getting closer, but I was, you know, I could have been another 10 years without catching that fish or something.
Yeah.
And it was starting to, you know, I wanted to be there all the time. And it was all I could think about, and I just wanted to be there. And you get drawn into it, don't you?
Yeah, it's, well, as I found out, it was, you know, the twin at Elstow that, you know, that got me, and then the fat lady after that. And it's ultimately a destructive way of living. You know, I've been with the same woman since I was 19. I'm very lucky in that respect, but I nearly threw it all away just to get a photo in the album.
Yeah, and when you look back on it, it seems daft, doesn't it?
Well, I look back now.
After time, but at the time, it's just the most important thing in the world. You know, there's no way you can just stop, is there?
No, not at all. And I'm glad I managed to catch the twin when I did, because I don't think I even cast a line for about 6 or 7 weeks after that. Just, you know, paid me overdraft off that I'd racked up, and just. You know, building bridges that had almost burnt down.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is that to it, and you know, after such a high, it takes a while for you to sort of build up to something else as well and get going again, doesn't it? You know, that's what I found. You know, like after you put so much in, what I found that with like the Mia, even when it all went wrong and all the fish died, I still found myself walking around there. You know, and I'm thinking, why am I walking around here? There's not even a fish in here anymore. But, I couldn't stop. It was weird.
Yeah, it's got to be memories in every corner of the lake. And,
people said, what are you going to go for now? And I thought, well, I can't even think about going. I couldn't just move on to another fish. You know, it's been such a huge sort of thing to take on for me, I couldn't think about targeting another fish. I just needed to chill out for a while, basically, and like you say, you know, get your life back together and do all the things that you should have been doing.
I love listening to Briggsy. He's such a nice fella, isn't he?
Oh, he's one of the nicest fellas, and one thing he's got is when you see him at the shows, he's got time for everyone as well, and you know, he's such such a nice, laid-back, easy-to-talk-to fella. There's a lot of good guys in fella. I know it's often said, but he is one of them, one of the best.
Yeah, and he's saying there, his love of fishing, his addiction made him want to work. It definitely influenced my work when I was young. You know, I've engineered my life to try and have as much time as possible to do what I want to do. I've never been get-told-what-to-do's. I've had warehouse jobs, I've had factory jobs the first 3 years of my sort of early life, and it wasn't for me. I needed to find something. But, you know, my early jobs were jobs that gave me 3 days off. I wouldn't take a job unless I could get 3 days off. So, you know, I had a job in a 24-hour garage because it was 4 days on, 3 days off, and it varied. So you got different nights of the week throughout the year. And I know there's a lot of people of work, shift work, just to make sure they've got the fishing time. So, and you know, I wanted to buy fishing equipment, I wanted to buy bait, I wanted to buy a new rod, so I made damn sure that I always worked, you know, until I got everything that I needed. Can you relate to that?
Oh, 100%. You know, I first started trying to get into writing articles for magazines.
Yeah.
It was because back then, you'd get paid for them. And that was my way of getting a few extra money to spend on fishing tackle or fuel to get to the lake or bait to throw in the lake. And, you know, so you write articles, it also helps you get noticed and get cheaper bait. That's why I started doing it. There's certainly, as anyone who knows me will tell you, there's no ego involved. And, you know, I could not do another magazine article or podcast and not really care. But that's what it does. Even, you know, doing things nowadays, you know, with the, you know, GRC, etc. You know, it's not for me. Well, it is. It's to help me fish. That is the only way it is. You know, it might sound a bit selfish because, you know, I do enjoy what I do at, you know, the shows, and I'm fortunate I find writing easy, but the end result of it all is I want stuff to help me fishing, and I've done the same as you. I've taken jobs 3 on 3 off, and you know, etc. I'm working in a tackle shop at the minute, and it's engineered, so I get Monday, Tuesday off every week.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crucial, the days off that you get, you know, with kind of, it is a sacrifice, you know. The people that have gone hardcore, I mean, you know, maybe you wouldn't want that lifestyle, but you look at the most obvious, your Terry Hearns, and there's no doubt he hasn't sacrificed a hell of a lot to be able to do what he's done in the last 20 years fishing. You know, I don't know if he has any regrets or if he doesn't, you know. I don't know anything about his personal life anymore. I don't know if he's settled down. Don't know if he ever wants kids. I don't know. I can't comment on any of it. But what I do know is what I need to keep me happy. And the priorities shift throughout your life. You know, we do need to be wanted by somebody. We do need a partner. You know, kids are a great thing as well, but not for everybody. But, you know, there's certain things I think you need as a human being, and interaction from fellow human beings other than smelly anglers is certainly one of them. So, you know, I wonder how many people have just literally, you know, given up their life. As Ian McMillan mentioned earlier about Martin Pick, you know, as somebody that went hardcore on the fishing and probably sacrificed girlfriends and stuff. And we do need it, don't we, in life? We do need human interaction.
Yeah, definitely. I could happily live without it for periods of time as well. But, you know, on a more personal, intimate note, you know, I'm lucky I've got the wife. You're lucky, yeah. I've got a handful of good friends, you know, who've never even picked up a fishing rod in their life.
Yeah.
You know, and even we get a bit of stick every now and then by going off tangents on the main casts. But, you know, we couldn't do this podcast if all we did, both of us, was go fishing, because we would be two extremely shallow, boring individuals.
Yeah, if you're one of those people that complain about us going off topic, somebody moaned in the long edition we released after Christmas this year, probably episode 66. It was advertised, you know, the guests were Roger Bacon and Nashi talking about rigs. It was an hour and 50 minutes of in-depth rig talk, and then there was an hour of me and you chatting, some of it fishing and some of it non-fishing, and somebody had the cheek to said too much off topic. I thought this was supposed to be a rig chat. Well, no, it's a news, views and gossip, and our podcast to do whatever we like with, and in the middle of it the feature is just short of 2 hours of in-depth rig chat, and somebody had the cheek to moan about that.
Yeah, it's not only rig chat. When you get Kev Nash and Roger Bacon,
yeah,
two of the best minds in the game.
Yeah, the point is, this guy will probably never listen to this, but you're a sad individual, because anybody that's whinging about 3 hours of free content, and maybe half an hour of that 3 hours was not technical and was just us chatting and had to cheat him on about off topic, he probably hasn't subscribed to the extra content, the little minging git.
And if we have, we'll soon find out.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly,
bloody hell, Jesus Christ, how long you got? I've got a bug, just on my relationships, I've got to tell you. Right, well, I've so far, well, two marriages. This is going to sound, it makes me sound like a bit of a Don Juan, but I'm trying to think, probably four strong relationships, two marriages. But carp fishing's what I do. You know, it's a very selfish attitude. But carp fishing has also enabled me to earn a reasonable living now. The company, Heathrow, obviously, I'll carp fish and run that, and that took a lot to run on its own. So the sacrifices I've made have been quite big. Although, when you know, where I am now in my life, we're quite comfortable, me and Debbie. I've got a lovely job with the loveliest company I've ever worked with. Not there's anything wrong with the other company I've worked with, of course, but then you reflect on your life when you're sitting there with them hours of fishing and you think, oh, I wasn't nasty. Not nasty in the way of nasty, if that makes sense, Mark, but you're very selfish and nothing mattered. You know, I've got two boys and a beautiful daughter. They all understand. They know my boys go fishing now. So the sacrifices I've made in younger life, it wasn't drinking and drugs. My drug and my drink was carp and angling as a whole. And that's cost me, yeah, it's cost me good cars, good holidays, you know, and good women. But there you go, I'm happy in my life now. I've got lovely children, lovely grandchildren, a lovely job. And I still, it burns even brighter now, the carp fishing within me.
as it does what the people I choose to fish with. So we all make certain sacrifices, and you know, even with EFO, if I didn't sell it, I could have earned a huge amount more money and been a real threat to some of these big guys out there now. But it was a time in my life I wanted to sell it, I wanted to do more fishing, because EFO was costing me my fishing. So, you know, I got on with my life, and I still love my fishing now, as I say, but inevitably, if you love something that much and it takes you away from home, things are always going to suffer, aren't they, mate? You know, I live with Debbie now. I mean, Debbie and I split up when I was early 20s because of various reasons that don't matter. But we got back together 5 years ago. Debbie totally understands. You know, I come over with fishing and say, love their biting. Go back. You don't get that, you know. So I'm very, 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 very lucky. As you said, you are, Mark. You know, another woman I live with, remain nameless, would never have had that. If I went for more than 24 hours, the clothes are on the doorstep, and I can't do that. This is my job. You know, it's something to give. But very lucky, very fortunate to have ended up in the place I'm at, mate. But it's cost the foreign holidays and all that. And my mate says, when you sit on the bank, if it was near in Florida four times, up near on a bend, you think, I went to Benidorm, you know. I went to Skegness, and I've been to France fishing, but I've been loads of places fishing. So in my mind, I'm very lucky in the place I visited, but in my relationships, I should have probably at the time been a bit more generous with said partner, but sorry, I'm where I am now, and I'm very happy now. So what you've done, haven't you? You can't go backwards. You keep moving forward, mate. Because if you reflect on what you should have... And I know what we're doing this for. This is for a questionnaire thing. But if you sit there all night with regrets in your mind, it brings you down. And you've got to look forward, turn the light, and move forward, haven't you? And that's the only way to do it, mate. Be positive. But don't ask my ex that. Do not phone my ex, because she might have a good story. So we'll leave her out of it, okay? No, I'm happy where I am now, mate. But extremely happy. But I'm well aware I've been very selfish during my life. Well, it's the same with everybody. I've got friends that still get... Most of my tutorial clients, sometime in that 24 hours or 10 hours or whatever we choose to add, we'll start talking about private lives. You all do. Every single one of them does it, because you run out of... How many fishing things can you discuss in 24 bloody hours? And it comes around to, well, do you know, to fish much? Oh, when she lets me. Now, I'm not being sexist, but I also believe a relationship is 50-50. So I shouldn't have to ask to go. But I promise you, Mark, everyone without fail has said, if she lets me. And I'm like, what do you mean she lets you? Because I'm quite gobby. Well, you have to ask. Well, no, you shouldn't have to ask. But if you don't ask, and they always come out with this, yeah, but you've just touched on this. If I don't ask, if I just go fishing, she's on the phone, we've got the and I'm not fishing. And that's so right. If your mind's not in it, you're not enjoying it, you might just want to not be there, aren't you? Well, no, you know, I've come out with fishing just to be told, you don't actually live anymore. So if I think, this is what I said earlier in what the questions, I'm less aggressive with my angling now, so I don't think I fit the bill of matches now. I'm more calm in the way I treat my fishing, but I still work very hard at it. But years ago, like you, if I had a score in my pocket, I know where that was going. And it keeps crossing to the southwesterly. I'd push the car there if I had to. So, but then again, in your life's journey, it's led me to be in a very privileged position now with my job. So it's brought you where you are, mate. So being selfish then, bosh, that's the way it is, isn't it?
There was certainly some advice there for some of you addicted to fishing. Maybe you're still a bit younger and, you know, you've got in your late teens, early 20s. And you kind of haven't worked out the life balance of, you know, home life, spending time with your girlfriend. Maybe you're just as obsessed as I was at that age. You just wanted to fish all the time. Some very valuable advice from Ian Russell there, because you do need a balance. Sometimes, you know, it might be more fun to be fishing. Sometimes you get completely addicted to a lake and that's the only place you want to be. But you definitely want to make time for your partner. I mean, I've been in the situation where you know, you're fishing for a particular fish or a group of fish, the A team of the lake, and it's almost like a race because your mates are fishing down there. It's very social, and every session, every night, every week that you miss, then you know you do think you're missing out on it. It might be a fish that gets caught a couple of times a year, and you think if you're not there when it gets caught, then you've missed it. But you'll always catch them. You'll have those fish eventually. You know, sometimes your name's on it and, you know, you can catch it pretty easily. You catch it early into a campaign. Sometimes a lake's going to make you wait 4 or 5 years to catch a fish that you know, other people have caught pretty quickly. I think it's going to happen when it's meant to happen. So in the meantime, you know, balance your life with your partner. And I don't know, I think it's, you know, if you find a girl that's really suitable for you, or, you know, if you're a lady listening to this and you're having the same situation the other way round, where your fella doesn't fish, you've just got to make time for both and make quality time. I think of the time that I've spent with partners, with my daughter, you know, with my folks in the past, and you know, sometimes I wish I'd have made a little bit more effort. I'd made a bit, you know, had even when I was there, instead of being there because I'm going through the motions and would just rather be on the bank, you know, ringing your mates up while you're there, see what you're missing, and, you know, spend that quality time, make it count, because we don't actually have that much time on this planet, and, you know, there's always going to be fish to catch, always.
Sacrifice as well. To take my first job in the tackle industry, I ditched a job that I had in Scotland, where I was a print ink technician, and I was working on all the presses up in Glasgow, and sort of worked my way up in the company a bit. I wouldn't say I sacrificed that, because, you know, when the opportunity came up to maybe get a job in the angling trade, it was something that I thought was quite exciting. I've certainly lost a lot of girlfriends through it. As we probably all have, you know, because if you think about it, it is a pretty selfish, obsessive pursuit. And if any of us were dating a girl who we thought the world of, and every time we came home from work on Friday looking forward to the weekend, she went off till Sunday, you wouldn't probably suffer it too long. And you look at it like that, you think, yeah, actually, it's quite a tall ask what we do. But, yeah, it's cost me a bit here and there. I suppose it's cost me a lot of diesel. And a lot of sort of time sat on motorways. But I couldn't say there was any great human sacrifice I've made. It's just been, you know, sort of soldiering, just keep on going against the odds when the lake's a long way away, or when you've only got a small amount of time to go fishing because you've got a busy job, and, you know, and you're just trying to make things fit. So, yeah, that's probably just a human story like everyone else who's listening to this can probably relate to. You know, they've just got to juggle things around and make sacrifices where they can. I mean, the amount of weddings and birthdays and things that I must have missed over the years is probably criminal. But, yeah, we sort of do what we can. And if we're afflicted with the carp fever and it takes hold of you, and it's a very selfish disorder, but only carp anglers really understand it. And like I say, well, you know, if you look at it from a woman's point of view and you think, right, so it's Saturday night, I want to get a takeaway and watch a video with my man, and yet he wants to get, it's February, he wants to be at a lake in the dark and the sleet on his own in a tent, freezing cold, to catch carp maybe that he's just going to put back. And then you think, cool, yeah, to the outside looking in, we're quite an odd bunch.
So we'll very soon be into February, which means, you know, the nights are already getting longer. You know, it's not pitch black at 4:30 at the minute. Things are improving. It's about that time of year we start to think of the longer spring nights, of the warm water, of fish showing again, of stuff acting naturally. And even though it's still a few months away, we can kind of make plans now, can't we? Picking our lakes, where we're going to fish, maybe picking how we're going to fish, maybe picking the bait that we're going to fish on, you know, the tactics we're going to go for this year. I mean, have you been thinking about that much?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And, you know, I'm on the waiting list. Well, I've paid my deposit for Monk's Pit. You know, I've been speaking to Ed Betteridge quite regularly, who's fished there and been quite successful. Same with Martin Wattle. I've been picking his tiny little brain. And I don't think he's got much left now, to be fair. You know, what I've not picked, he's pickled. And I know he doesn't subscribe either, so I can say it. But yeah, I've got all these ideas in my mind. You know, I've mentioned, you know, I'm looking forward to getting the zigs out in the spring, and
you know, certain areas. Well, I say certain areas, they've just been down there with the reed cutters. You know, they've taken a lot of Norfolk reeds out of them. I mean, there was a swim called the Chat Room, I believe, which was, you know, deep in them. And even through the winter, a lot of fish will be holed up in there. And come the spring, it'd be one angler in, one out. You know, people almost queuing for the swim. And, you know, for every, I don't know, 15, 20 fish or so that swim would do, the rest of the lake would do, you know, one or two during a period of time in the spring. You remember how it used to be in the reed swim on Elstow 1?
Yeah.
It was a very similar situation. But they've had the reed cutter in and they've absolutely annihilated them all.
It's a good time of year to be doing research, isn't it, on your new lake? If you're starting a fresh lake, you know, finding out the habits, where do the big ones come from, you know, what parts of the lake do fish at what times of the year. I'll tell you, so I did it. The reason why I started fishing Pit 2 at Elstow in February was not because I thought I had any chance of catching fish. It was to learn the lake before it warmed up. So basically, how I approach a new lake is to fish a different swim every night, you know, unless I'm obviously on fish and I see fish. But if you're going to start early in the year specifically to find features and stuff, then, you know, there's a good chance you're probably not going to be on fish because you're starting before the fish wake up. But obviously, if I got an opportunity to catch fish, I would fish for them. But generally, I'm going to try and do two or three nights a week for 3 or 4 weeks in a row, early in the year before the fish wake up, and I'm basically feature finding in each swim. I fish a different swim every night, so most swims at most lakes, you know, you've probably got 8 to 12 swims I would say that you want to be in. As I mentioned on an earlier podcast, with this one or the one before, you can rule out areas sometimes, you know, if there's 3 swims in a similar area, then, you know, pick one in that area of the lake, try and pick them on all the different winds and fish them. Make sure you know where the humps and bumps are, you know, when you're not worried about disturbing fish, because the last thing you want is to get an opportunity in April or May or whatever and there's fish all over you and you've never cast a lead out in that swim before, you know, and you're going to risk spooking the fish off, especially when there's not a lot of weed about early in the year. You know, it doesn't take much, you know, if there's no natural holding area for the fish, such as, you know, big weed beds and stuff, which there quite often isn't in the spring, then you can spook them out with repeated casting. And I don't know if you're like me, but I like being on the best possible spots in the swim, and I'll thrash it to a foam to make sure I find them. So I'd rather do that now, January, February, before the fish wake up. Do your homework, write it down in your books, use the Fox Swim Mapper or whatever, or the notes application on iPhone's really good now, because you can actually take pictures within notes and then type, you know, 7.5 wraps or 20 wraps or whatever, 4 foot deep bar, and just get to know the spots when you do get that opportunity, especially if you're on limited time and you know, you don't get much of a chance. You don't want a 48 hour session move into a swim on fish and then ruin that chance by leading around. Do you subscribe to that?
Oh, 100%. I mean, that's one thing I'm, you know, kind of looking forward to with you know, getting down Monks. You know, so Ed was telling me there's no clique on there and everyone is really friendly and they're more likely to put you onto a spot than try and throw a blind or just not tell you anything. So yeah, I'm looking forward to, but I didn't know that you could do that with the was it the Notes app you said on the iPhone?
Yeah.
Take pictures. Well, I'm certainly going to be using that one. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's on one of the more recent iOS upgrades. But yeah, you can. I've got a few in mind now from Nash's over the winter. It's just sometimes quicker than going into the Fox Swim app, which is really good, that the Fox app, you know, it's pretty detailed. But sometimes you've just been really quick. If you've not been on that lake before in that swim, you kind of have to set it up, take the aerial photo, use Google Maps or whatever, set the lake up, then add the swim. And sometimes it's just easy to, you know, get the Notes app on the front of the iPhone, take the picture, and then right underneath 7.5 wraps at the pump shed or whatever it is, you know.
The pump shed, which swim is that? Then you're just giving away.
Yeah, and it's 7.5 wraps at the pump shed, so it's on Nash's Copse Lake.
Is that lengthways?
On the lengthways and the swim at the head, and there's the old pump that they used. They've got new ones on there now, but the old pump had it looks like a little dog kennel that sits over the top of the electric to stop it getting wet. It's directly on line with that.
Yeah, since you're giving away, I'll give one away, which I think is quite
quite apt. It'll apply to probably next to no one, but there's a swimming icon. It's called the Tire Swim. You're fishing parallel with the end of an island, and there's a spot I've taken fish from to over 30 pound. I just call it the arse. It's about, I think it's 20 or 21 wraps. You know, you're in about 11 or 12 foot of water, but on the horizon there's two trees, and they're just shaped like a perfect woman's bottom. Without, you come to a nice crack in the middle of them. Or am I a pervert?
Yeah, there's a.
You get lonely on the bank, these, especially on a place like there where you just don't see people and all sorts of things running through your mind.
Moving on, we have influences. So I know in our first series of Carpcast Extras, we did our main influences. You know, we saw the Rod Hutchinsons come up a hell of a lot. I wonder how many younger carpers are citing Terry Hearn as influences. I know, is it Sean Ong, was it? You used to.
Yeah, he certainly influenced me on a personal level because I got to know him as a friend. But now I'm thinking the younger carpers nowadays are going to look at people like, you know, Daryl Peck, who was younger than the both of us.
Yeah.
Who I see has just been nominated for the Carp Talk Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I did see that, yeah. Congratulations to Daryl.
Yes, definitely.
I think his quote underneath that he put was, I was just a lad that went fishing, which is, which was... kind of the same expression Tom Doherty also used when he caught a 70 pounder. I'm not sure he's gone in the Hall of Fame for that just yet, but maybe with his achievements later on in the future, maybe he will. But yeah, I'm just a lad who went fishing. But yeah, congrats to Daryl. I guess Daryl will come up a lot with the sort of younger generation in future years. You know, I read his stuff with interest, the Orient stuff, the foreign stuff, the Belgium lakes, you know, although Daryl was a friend for a lot of years and we fished together a lot on a few different lakes, you know, he still inspires me. I don't know about influences, but certainly inspires me.
Yeah, do you think there's much of a difference between influence and inspire?
Yeah, definitely. I think influence has a direct impact on what you do. You know, like, you know, there's a lot of people probably fished Yateley Car Park Lake because of Terry Hearn influences. Inspire might just make you want to go out and be a bit better than yourself. You know, maybe when you go out and try a bit harder on a lake, it doesn't actually mean you're going to go and copy what someone did. Yeah.
Maybe from that, I had... just after the Cat Society show, I had a couple of nights on Farlow's. You know, the second night I spent in the company of John Llewellyn, you know, formerly of LA Carp, who is now doing the same baits as he always done through his own Big Carp UK. But what a lot of people will not know, he's competed in three Olympics.
Wow.
Yeah, fencing.
Ah, like, and Bruce Dickinson from Iron Maiden.
Yes, although I'm sure he could kick Bruce's ass.
Well, Bruce Dickinson was in the England Olympic fencing team.
Yeah. Oh, wow. I wonder if John knows him. He can hook us up. Mm. I won't mind some free maiden tickets. But yeah, I was chatting with John. He's super knowledgeable about bait. But, you know, we got talking, you know, a little bit about, you know, his Olympics and just, you know, the mindset of it. Because obviously anyone who's competed in that sort of level is uber competitive. You know, there's nothing to top it. And it was, you know, just saying about the training and the drive, because he says you wake up every morning think, if I don't get up, if I don't do this, if I don't work that bit harder, my opponent will. I need to be better.
Yeah, that's a good way of thinking about it.
It did get me thinking. Certainly an inspiring chap.
Yes, certainly. Just had a text of Alan Young. I don't hear from him very often. Yeah. Famous Northwest rod builder, built last two sets of rods that I had. Got the blanks from Nash, and let him go to town on them. I still use them now, and I only hear from him about once a year. Normally, I've not heard from him for a couple of years actually. So, I'm interested to see what he's texting about.
He's still got those Diaramorphoses. Did he rebuild those as well?
He did. Yeah, have I got one left? They broke one by one over the years. I had them a lot of years, 15 years, 16 years. broke for various reasons, trapped in car doors and all sorts. But yeah, I think I've got one left. Yeah, the Amorphous. But yeah, right, let's move on to other people's influences.
Biggest influence on my carping. Oh my God. I've got a name drop now, or it's just like my testimony of
for
the last few years.
But I'll give credit where it's due.
A generic. I think credit where it's due. I think, you know, I grew up reading people like Tim Paisley, Frank Warwick, Bill Cotton, Brian Garner, Julian Cundiff. You know, I wrote to Julian and he replied. So I used to be kind of in awe of these people, not to the point where I used to sort of look lovingly at them. Just, and it was very bizarre that when I got into the industry and then became whatever I've become, you know, all these people are friends who I've spent time with and fished with and spoke to on numerous occasions. And I think what hit home with me about, certainly about Tim Paisley, is one, his ability as a writer is not rivaled. He is without doubt one of the best writers. He's not the funniest writer or the most witty, but he is a very knowledgeable writer that enables the reader to be there with him on a session. Terry Earn's got that gift, and so has Tim Paisley. Certainly in his books like From the Bivvy and these session pieces that he writes, he very much puts you in that swim with him. And I went to a 2005 England v France carp match. Lord knows why, looking back. I'd run out of pins to stick in my eyes or something, so I ended up getting involved in this stupid match down on the Pyrenees. It wasn't like it was local at Brasenose or something. And it only hit home at me. But that, you know, that's going back 11 years. So England won the match, and it was almost like a ready ring of aura that was around Tim, not just by the English, perhaps less so by the English anglers, but more the Europeans. It was a European v England sort of thing. And people were just in awe of him. And I remember him sitting at a table, and he doesn't give it the big bollocks, he hasn't got an ego, but he was sitting there, and there was very much that vibe that, you know, he is the Don, I'm the daddy. And that's what it was, ever so bizarre. And he wasn't doing anything, and he wasn't being untoward, or he wasn't drunk. He was just sitting there being himself, and I think that was what people call respect. And I think he commands it because he's done so much for carp fishing over the years. And I grew up reading his stuff, and I still love reading his stuff. And Frank, Bill Cotton, again, is the same, a very funny guy that can make me giggle and that takes not himself or the industry too seriously. Julian, for being Julian, because he's just so enthusiastic, and how he fits everything into his life, I don't know, you know. But I think over the last 15 years or so, since I've been in the industry, people like Ian Russell, just for his joviality, and he's been a very, very good friend of mine for a lot of time, a long years. And we don't see each other as much because we don't live near each other, you know, and either this thing and I, but we could not see each other for years, and then we were just like, we haven't been apart. We're very, very close friends, even though we don't live in each other's pockets. But he's so full of life, and he's so full of enthusiasm. And his ability, and I think I've said it before, I've written before, that if I had to pick one person to save my life and get me a bite from any lake in the world at any time, it would be Ian Russell. And he's been such a massive, not just an influence, but a friend. We've been through a lot of personal shit together, both him and me, and we've always been there for each other, you know. And I suppose another person, whilst we don't see eye to eye, we didn't do when I left Cord, it was Danny Fairbrass. And, you know, we became quite close, me and Danny, because we'd fished together a lot on Thinking Tackles and DVD projects. And I suppose it hurt him when I left, because I massively underestimated what I meant to him as a friend, based on the fact that I think that's how Danny forms his friendships on the bank. But, you know, I'm not a great winter angler, or sometimes I'd lose my mojo and Danny'd ring, or we'd be talking about some sort of DVD project or where we're going to go. And I would, it could be January the 10th, and it's -2 in the night, and it's 1 degree in the day, and it's absolutely shit. And you know you're probably not going to stand the cat and owl's chance of catching a carp. But you come off the phone after an hour's conversation with Danny Fairbrass, and you want to throw your gear into the van and drive as far as possible and get your odds out.
he's so enthusiastic. And again, whilst we had a fallout when I left, I'll never ever not have respect for him as a person, for not only what he's done for fishing, or what, you know, he's a self-made millionaire, and I think people love to hate Corder because he's popular. People love to hate success. Now, I'm not like that, you know. I'll never ever not give people credit where it's due. And Danny just loves carp fishing. People think he loves it because he makes copious amounts of money. Now, obviously, he does make copious amounts of money, but he is also one of the most passionate, enthusiastic anglers that I've ever known. You know, alongside, he's probably more passionate than Ian in a different way. Danny's more serious than me and Ian would go fishing, or we'll go to France and we will just piss around the whole time. And fishing will be very much secondary. With Danny, fishing is always first. You know, he's very driven and very focused, and he's very enthusiastic. And you couldn't fail, even in your darkest days, to come off the phone and not be picked up by his enthusiasm. You know, so that he did have an influence on me for a lot of years. And you know, we haven't fallen out. You know, we just still say hello, and we're nowhere near what we were because I chose to take a different path with another company. But you know, it doesn't stop me from having the respect and the admiration for what he's done with Corder. You know, bear in mind he started with a lead mould and a dog bowl. So how can you not have respect and admiration and be influenced by somebody with that much drive? You know, and I suppose that nobody will ever have heard of is a guy named Danny Stroud. And I think you mentioned earlier about people that make it look so easy. Now, this boy is different gravy. I met him down on Christchurch 15 years ago, and he was streets ahead, absolutely streets ahead, and he still is to this day. He's never seek publicity. He's a bricklayer. And I remember when I used to work at Armoured, and I used to try and bribe him with untold amounts of free kit. And because he had got a slight bit of arrogance, Dan, he'd just tell me to get off. You know, so you're in a grand a week, Tong. So I'm a bricklayer, so I don't need any free shit. That's what he would say, you know. And but his photo album is to die for. And you and Jamie will know anglers like that. He doesn't want publicity. He goes fishing and just makes it look so easy. You could tell him. I remember taking him to Hardwick when all the originals were still in, and it was a very much a social trip. And we went on the spit, and I fished a plateau out in the middle of the Anio, and I said, "There's a couple of little spots in the cut through." He said, "Yeah, no problem." So I was about 60 yards up the bank. I was consciously watching him. I was having a lead around. And he didn't fish any of the spots that I told him to do. Within 3 hours, I think he'd had 3 30s fishing. You know, he's meticulousness in finding spots. He's very, very good at finding spots. And he's quite arrogant in the sense that he would never fish somebody else's spot. He's not that sort of angler because he just doesn't do it that way. He does it his own way. And he just makes everything. He's casting, he's feature finding, his confidence is just absolutely unrivaled. I've never met an angler that is so naturally gifted that makes it look so easy in my whole life. So he's been a big influence. And I could try and bribe him now with 3 Shimano black mags, and he'd still tell me to bollocks, and he'd rather buy them and not owe anybody for any publicity. That's the sort of angle that he is, Danny. But he's just different gravy.
There's a lot of familiar names come up in this. You know, a lot of the obvious ones, and obviously Laney's and stuff. But a nice one to hear is Julian Cundiff. So, you know, Ian was probably one of many people that wrote to Julian, and as we know, Julian writes back to everybody. There is nobody he doesn't reply to. You know, he almost lives for it, doesn't he? And I'm sure he's been a huge influence on a lot of people, hasn't he?
Oh, without a doubt, he's certainly influenced me, and I'm lucky enough now to be able to call him a friend. You know, he's a lovely fellow. He has a great taste in music, good hair, and he catches a ton of carp.
Yeah, and he relates to a lot of people because he's never specifically gone for, you know, the elitist waters, has he? He fishes the normal water, the runs waters. He fishes still at, well, I don't know how old Julian is now. I don't want to do him a disservice, but I imagine he's a few years older than me, so he's got to be around the 50 mark.
And he's slightly over 50.
Yeah, and he's he's still doing overnighters after work, you know, setting up in the dark and the rain and getting up at 5:30 in the morning to leave back for work, and he's doing that at 50 odd. So every credit to Julian. He should be an influence to a lot of people there, because a lot of people could learn a lot from him in the fishing industry, both other name anglers, you know, for seeing the time and the effort that he gives to, you know, young keen anglers, and just the fact that he's still doing it, and, you know, and loves, clearly loving it.
Yeah, definitely. I also, because it's good for someone like, you know, Ian McMillan, who's, you know, reached that level himself, to still give kudos and respect to, you know, the people, you know, like Jules, who helped him along the way.
And I never forget walking into a show once and bumping into Julian, and he made a point of coming up to me, shaking my hand and saying, you know, I didn't know this guy would know me from Adam. You know, this is what, long before, you know, I'd caught a few fish and maybe done one or two articles, but, you know, I was very early on the carp scene, and he knew exactly who I was. He came up and congratulated me for whatever fish that I'd caught, and it meant a lot for somebody of his status to had even knew I existed, you know. So it's nothing but respect for Julian.
The first really, really big influence was Rob Malin. No question about it. I've just impaled something on my finger. Hang on a second. I had a safety pin in this shirt. I think I just stabbed it into my pin. Yeah, sorry. When Rob's books came out in 19, I think the first one was 88, Tiger Bay, it totally, we didn't really have fishing heroes then. We like reading Dick Walker stuff and various stuff, but there hadn't really been, he was like a, it's hard to explain it, just what Rob Malin was then. He was like the ultimate carp fishing hero, because not only did he catch loads of fish, but he was bloody funny. And he loved going up the curry house and telling great stories. And he was always getting caught doing something wrong. And his books were just phenomenal, full of these fish after fish. He was obviously a phenomenal angler, but he knew how to tell a story. He had these two sections in his books that really, really used to draw us in like moths to a flame. One was the guest chapters, which were always brilliant. But the greatest, but he always had a rig chapter. And we were really, really obsessed with rigs then. We thought that was the answer. It was all to do with rigs, and Rob used to write quite, you know, whether it was a swimmer rig or a loony extension or whatever it was, you know, he used to write about them. And Rob Malin, yeah, definitely, all three of his books, you know, from Tiger Bay to Fox Pool to Basil's Bush, we hung on every word, and you know, they were like true heroes to us, you know, in the guest chapters, Richard McDonald catching Pad Lake Jumbo and Heather the Lever, and, you know, some of this stuff was just monumental. And yeah, that really, really inspired me. And then after that, Terry Earn came along and caught all our attention when he caught Mary. I mean, I was aware of him anyway from reading Rob's magazine, Big Carp, that he had been catching all these big fish down at Yateley. You know, he'd already made a name for himself before he caught Mary. But then when he did, I was working at Drennan, and Peter and I decided, let's get him. Let's see if we can get him on board, you know, as a sponsored angler to help with the launch of the ESP brand. And I drove down and picked Terry up at Yateley Angling Centre, and he was coming up in, and I borrowed Peter's Mercedes, and I've driven down there and picked Terry up, and he was there in his sort of fishing clothes with a pair of optics around his neck, in Yateley Angling Centre, talking to John Lockwood, and you know, introduced myself, and he then was, you know, he probably, he eclipsed Rob to me, really, because he was younger, and I'd met him, and I got to fish with him all the time, loads, you know. And to say that he influenced me would be a massive understatement. You know, you can't, if you're really excited and passionate and live carp fishing, and then you're exposed to someone like that, you know, you'd be a fool not to soak in everything you could, you know. And yeah, so I learned a lot off Terry that I'm sure still holds me in good stead today. And those two, Rob less directly because it was more through books, although I've got to know him personally in later years, but at the time it was just through his books. And Terry very directly through actually fishing with him when he was the British record holder and the most sort of, well, he still is, you know, one of, if not the most respected anglers around. So, Terry and Rob, they're the two.
It goes without saying that Rob Malin and Terry Hearn, probably the, you know, two of the biggest influences for everybody, especially Terry Hearn in the modern day carp scene. I mean, a lot of people from my era, as we spoke before, were Rod Hutchinson, Kevin Maddox, but Rob Malin, I mean, he was such a great storyteller and obviously wrote a lot of books, you know, still makes his money out of the publishing game now with his magazine Big Carp and many carp books. So let's move on. Let's go and check out Ian Russell's influences.
Gosh, you know what? There's two people actually. I know, like you, because you touch your toe in the trade and the industry, Mark. I know a huge amount of people, and some of the youngsters are phenomenal anglers. But if I talk about influence on me and who changed my direction of angling, two people. Derek Ritchie, I always refer to him as my uncle. He's a lovely, lovely man. He's forgotten more about carp fishing than most of these youngsters will ever bloody know. Was catching diggings when they weren't there to be caught. Lovely man, very friendly. Very open with everything. He's never been sneaky, snidey. I fished a lot with Derek when I was younger. I met him at Waverley Valley donkeys years back. And he has influenced me massively on how to catch numbers of carp and how to be sneaky with it. And the other person I refer to as my surrogate father, who is very, very, very extremely kind to me when I lost my own dad, is Ronnie Buss. And I've just had a week in France with Ron, actually, 2 weeks back. And them two guys, if you look back through history, they're both renowned for catching numbers. But they, you know, when they were younger men, the big fish weren't there. What they were catching were the big fish of their day, big 20s and 30s. And they were slaughtering them, you know, calling the phrase, horrible phrase, but they were slaughtering them. And their tactics are very, very, very basic, like you've touched on with the two rigs. And they've influenced my angling no end. And they are ancient old gits now, but I love them to bits. And they still stand up as two of the best anglers I've ever fished with on the bank because they don't complicate things. And it shows you that we're fishing for carp, not scientists. You know, so, and ironically enough, when I've done my battle carp things that we also spoke about earlier, I stuffed them both. But that was because they're talking, and they both said, "We taught you too well, you sneaky git." But they're lovely people that are massive in my heart, them two guys, you know. But again, I know I keep repeating myself, like you, I know a lot of people in the trade. I know some phenomenal anglers from all types of angling, from match angling to just pleasure angling, carp, and you know, single fish angling, but and they're all bloody good at what they do. But them guys, I was learning without realising it at the time when I was fishing when I was younger, because you just watch them. You don't have to ask them guys. You know, if you're shrewd enough and the fishing is within you, you'll notice the bits that most people miss. And so they've been huge in my world, mate. And to beat them both in a match, I've got to tell you, mate, when I knew I'd drawn them, and they were both on Berry Hill at Dorking, which they both were. Derek didn't know so well, but Ronnie's fished since he was dug. To beat them both on Berry Hill was, for me, in my own mind, was phenomenal, mate. So love them to bits, the pair of them, and they're still massive in our industry.
Derek with Don Ritchie, he, one of Ian Russell's influences. Certainly a larger than life character. He was doing it. I remember when we had him on the carp cast, you know, he was catching 20 pounders before I was born. So he's glad to see that he's an influence for some people. You know, he's a very positive, outgoing guy, and we hope to have him on at the Northern Angling Show this year, actually. Doing his crazy stage show. We've not had him yet, so looking forward to that. But Derek Richard, do you follow much from him? I mean, it was more of an Essex thing, wasn't he, back in the day?
Yeah, I remember seeing a video. This was in the early days of YouTube. I can't remember where it was, but he was in his bivvy somewhere, and he's got some crappy rave tune booming across the lake. And I thought, oh my god, that's, don't ever come to my lake, please. But, you know, you can't deny his place. You know, he's been around forever. He's caught a lot of fish, and he is a larger-than-life character. You know, he's, again, he's an asset to carp fishing.
And he mentions Ronnie Buss there. I don't know if you've had many dealings with Ron Buss, but I only saw him last year in the Northern Anglia show, the first time I'd really spoke to him. They had a charity stand, I forget, one of the Anglers Against Cancer type stands that we have at the show. And again, he seemed to be very well respected. The people that were, you know, hanging around the stand chatting to him, you know, a who's who of well-known people themselves. He seems to have, again, being up north and him down south and never run into him before, it was nice to see. You know, you can see that you can see the circles, people moving, sort of thing. And and obviously he's doing a lot of good things for the charity stuff as well, all for charity. Let's move on.
Yeah.
So who would you say is the person that had the most influence on you when you were young as an angler?
I would think, I lived in Deptford in South East London, so basically when I come out to Dartford on the train, Dartford was like coming out into the country in comparison to Deptford. And when I like progressed to carp fishing, because I see all these guys sitting around the lake, you know, floppy hats and everything, you know, everything's so secretive and everything, wouldn't talk to you in most cases. I used to take no notice, you know, they just thought they were a little bit ignorant, to be honest with you. And then when I actually got hooked on carp fishing, I used to keep a scrapbook with all, I used to cut pictures out of the anglers, Mao anglers' times, anything else that had carp caught from Kent and everything, and you used to cut all the articles out and everything. And I suppose the writings of people like Jimmy Gibbinson and Jerry Savage, that was a very big influence on me, because I hung on every word they said, and there's some good stuff in their articles, you know. I mean, Jerry's art was predominantly revolved around bait, and Jim's was all sorts, you know. And there was another guy I bumped into on the lake. I mean, I was fortunate enough to catch a 24-pounder in February 1972, which was a big fish for the time, and I put it in the Anglian Times, I think it was. And I can remember applying to join the BCSG on the strength of that fish. I was only 15 years old. Well, I say I was nearly 16, it was a couple of days before my 16th birthday, and I applied for the BCSG on the strength of that, because big BCSG was a thing to get into at the time, you know.
Yeah.
Obviously, was an ambition, something you aim for. But when I got the form back and saying, like, how many doubles caught this year, last year, and I thought, well, I ain't quite ready yet. but the following week, after that appeared in the Anglian Times, I walked around Alton Kirby, I just got to Alton Kirby where I caught the fish from, and this guy all dressed as a soldier, you know, and had all the gaiters and everything, you know, and he just turned around at me and said, well done with your fish, mate. I said, oh, thank you very much. And it was a guy called Tony Owls. And he was a real nice fella, and all his gear was really smart and everything. He had the old fibre tube rods with the Beachcaster rings on them and everything, and he was very helpful, you know. He was obviously a very, very good angler, and because he lived in Walthamstow, he used to give me a lift home on his way home, and so we became quite good friends. And he was a big influence, one of the main things. I mean, to this day, he used the biggest baits I've ever seen. You know, really? He used to use, like, this was three line pace baits, and they was the size of oranges. And on his third rod, if he ever used the third rod, he used to use luncheon meat. And he'd open a can of luncheon meat and cut it in half, and half a tin to go in the hook, you know. Yeah. And I can remember when I started fishing Darrup, because the fish had spawned on Darrup Creek Lake in 1970, this is about sort of mid-70s now, 74, 75 maybe, there was a lot of small carp in Darrup Creek Lake, and that's all I could catch. And I can always remember Tony didn't catch very many, but what he did catch were big ones. And I can remember one round of him, I caught about seven fish this morning, all sort of, you know, 5-6 pounders, and Tony caught a 20-pounder off the road bank at Darrup, and I wandered around to him and I said, I don't know what to do, I've got to catch a big fish, Tony. And he said,
you know, on the outset. I weighed 7 this morning, but the biggest one's been at 6-7 pounds. So I told you, it was bigger baits. And I went back to my swim and opened a tin of lunch in me. I couldn't quite bring myself to put half a tin on it, but, you know, I put about a third of a tin on it and cast out, caught 16-pounder. So, you know, he was quite a big influence on me, really. Tony, you know, he was a good bloke as well, but unfortunately he died of cancer 2 or 3 years ago. And, you know, but he was a good bloke. He was always in the, I mean, always in the Anglian Times and things like that. Good mate of Derek Stritton's. Yeah, proper nice bloke and a proper, like, influence on me. And the other one, really, is Rod Hutchinson. Rod Hutchinson, I know Rod Hutchinson personally, you know, albeit I haven't bumped into him for 2 or 3 years now, you know, but I know him as a friend. I've fished with Rod on a couple of occasions, but to me, he's a god of carp fishing. Yeah, he's got such a good knowledge of all aspects of, I mean, he's an old man now, and he's got his problems and whatever. But as far as his understanding of carp fishing, he's possibly one of the most instinctive anglers I've ever seen on the bank. And his knowledge of bait was, you know, brilliant. And, you know, he played a big influence on, like, the early days of continental fishing. And, yeah, I mean, Rod the God, they all call him, but because to me, Rod is, you know, Rod stands out head and shoulders above the rest.
I like that. And, Rod the God. I like that.
Yeah.
He was, said it many times on this show, he was the same for me. He was my influence, you know. He was The Carp Strikes Back, was a fantastic book. And I was at the right age when that came out, you know. I was like 13, 14 years old, and he was funny as well, you know, as well as as very clever. So, yeah.
I can remember going to, the first time I went to his house when he lived in Louth. His bookcase, it was boxing books, there was football books and everything. And when I got in conversation about boxing and football with him, and, you know, he done pretty well with them as well, you know. Yeah. So it was one of them people who, whatever he put his hand to, he was good at, you know. And I think he's head and shoulders above the rest for the employees in the, you know, the future carp anglers. But having said, the unfortunate thing is, you walk around a lake in the UK now and mention Rod Hutchinson and he's been forgotten. He's a great bloke, Rod, quite a fantastic angler, you know, the best ever, I think, you know, and carp angler. Very big influence. Another person, interestingly, who influences me, not because he's an inspiration to me, should I say, is Tim Paisley. Because Tim Paisley, I mean, in the early days, I didn't used to get on very well with Tim, because I used to think he was such a, you know, excuse my swearing, but a bit of a self-righteous bastard. But when I got to know him and fish with him, like maybe in these World Championship matches, you know, and you see, look, a man of his age, and he's still doing it. You know, he's still out there in the boat, and, you know, he's good at it, and you know, he's got a good understanding of it. He writes brilliant articles about it and stories about it, and, you know, and you know, it's my sort of, I think, myself, I hope I'm like it when I'm his age, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's still, you know, and he's got a saying, like, keep on keeping on, and he does, you know. Fantastic. Yeah, so he rates highly in my eyes.
Right, okay. There's been a few people, I think, you know where I'm going to end up, but like Bob Davidson. I was in another place in the army for a few years, and that's about as much as I'm going to say on it. And when I came back to the real world, I decided that I wanted to get into this carp fishing. I've been a fisherman all my life, but carp fishing was the furthest thing my thought, coming from the West Country. We didn't even know Evolution had invented carp, you know, and it's still bad down there to this day. But yes, When I got back to Aldershot, of course, lots of things had happened since I was in, had been away. They'd built all these roads, there were gravel pits everywhere. They were all full of carp. And he showed me the hair rig. And he was the only person, and I mean the only person, that was ever going to help me. And I fished on the water. I had 7 fish in it. It took me a long time to catch them, but I did catch them all in the end. And Bob's little hair rig was when he showed me it was probably a massive part of that. And there were a few people along the way, but yeah, I mean, let's get to the point. I think meeting someone like Laney is going to influence you probably on a whole host of levels. Certainly the speckled hen and barbecues and stuff like that. But to watch him, and I don't know if he's the same today, because Dave and I don't unfortunately go fishing. He moved over to Suffolk, and he's fishing waters that I can't get to. My wife, bless her heart, isn't well a lot of the time, and I have to be near to home. I get very worried about being a long way from home. But in those early years, watching what he did at Horton, what he did at Raysbury, and subsequently and many other places, to me, there are some very technically gifted anglers around, and very very mechanical people, but Dave is quite naturally the greatest carp angler I've ever met. And I hate saying it, because he'll probably ring me up when he hears this and really really take the mic, but yeah, he's a special angler and a very special bloke.
Yeah, and he's just caught a fish that I never caught as well.
Yeah, 52 something. Yeah, it's he rang me up the day before, and he'd found a way of, you know, after all the struggles he'd had there, and he had, and he'd be the first to admit that, he'd found a way of doing something. He started catching a few, and we both said, I was out filming, believe it or not, with fishing TV, and he rang me and he said, you know, if I'm having it, I'm having it soon. And the next morning he rang me, and yeah, the rest, as they say, is history. Yeah, an incredible man. He's 8th UK 50, and yeah, if you don't let people like that influence your life, then I think you're quite a sad person.
Can't argue with Chilly at all, nor would you ever want to, but yeah, some influences. Obviously Dave is the man, and they still think so. We've just got one left on this one, hitting around the 2 hour mark now. So the nicest guy in fishing, let's check out Mr. Briggs.
Well, they've been, I really do get influenced by loads and loads of people all the time. You know, and people who, you know, it could be kids. I see something a kid's doing, and they don't even realise what they're doing sometimes. You know, and I see things, and you know, so yeah, there's a lot of influences. I suppose, I mean, there is obviously major ones. You know, in terms of, you know, sort of, well, it talks about work ethic. In terms of work ethic, Tim Paisley, I mean, he's a huge influence, because he just keeps going. He's unstoppable. And, you know, I mean, carp angling is mainly a young people's game. You know, most of the carp anglers you see, wherever you go in the shows or whatever, most of them are sort of younger. And a lot of them, they get to a certain age and they drift sort of out of it. Some of them still go, but you know, the seriousness of it is gone. And even like some of the people who were huge names like 10, 15 years ago, they just sort of drift away from it. You know, and I really want to sort of keep going. You know, I feel like I haven't even really started to sort of reach my potential, if you know what I mean. That's what I feel like. And so, like, I see that in Tim Paisley. You know, he really sort of keeps going. His drive is unbelievable. And, you know, that's a huge inspiration for me, just watching him over the years, his drive and determination to do things. And that really inspires me to just keep going. It makes me realise that as long as you've got that drive and determination, you know, anything's possible. There's nothing to stop you doing it if you want to do it. And so certainly, you know, Tim Paisley in that way. Yeah, I mean, there's lots of other influences over the years. You know, Rod Hutchinson was a huge inspiration in the early years, say around the mid-80s. Certainly when I started going to Cassian, you know, a lot of it was because of Rod Hutchinson and what he was doing at the time. You know, and I can even say, like, Kevin Ellis, you know, that picture of Kevin Ellis with his 76-pound mirror at Cassian. It was a huge influence on me back in those days. And I still look at that picture now and it amazes me. So there's lots and lots of things that have inspired me. You know, like going back to when I started carp fishing, there were so many of the big names fishing around me at the time, you know, Bob Morris and people like that. Jack Hilton even come down to Brooklands. You know, so I was inspired by all of that. There's been lots of people who have sort of inspired me and influenced me over the years. But I guess the biggest one has got to be Tim Paisley, really, just because of his drive and determination to do things.
One thing Steve said there is carp fish is mainly a young person's game. Would you agree with that?
I would and I wouldn't.
I think the people that are heavily into it now, from our generation onwards, are still going to be fishing when they're 50s and 60s. I think the thing is, like, when Steve was, you know, 20s, they're probably, you know, carp fishing wasn't as big as it is now. And obviously, you know, him and he mentions people like Tim, and, you know, we've spoke about some others, you know, people like your Derek Riches, 60s and 70s that are still bang at it. I think there will be a lot of older carpers when our generation, you know, hits retirement age and above, and then when the generation behind us, because it's a way of life fishing, isn't it? So, and it's nice to hear him talk about Tim Paisley as well, because that was obviously an influence for people of his age, because Tim Paisley's work ethic and everything, it's been there from day one, hasn't it?
Oh, without a doubt, and he certainly influenced me. I remember, do you remember his book, To Catch a Carp?
Yeah.
Like a blue cover, and had a picture of him with the big scaly fish and the mangrove, which I believe was an upper 30. And I think that book's probably got to be around 20 years old now. And, you know, whereas most, you know, males of that age have got dog-eared porn mags under the bed, mine was Tim Paisley's book.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to make you do the interview with him for the Carpcast. That's your task this week. I'll set it up if you want, or I'm pretty sure Jules will for you, but make that happen. I think you'll be good to interview him.
Yeah, I'll be nervous if I'm honest.
Good. Well, let's hear that interview. Let's hear that interview. So a big thank you to all of our guests this week. Call of nature for me, Mark, so we're going to wrap this one up. But yeah, I've enjoyed it. It's always nice hearing influences, isn't it? The inspirational stuff is a good thing in fishing.
Yeah, definitely. Do you think, well, I also, on the other side of it, it's also nice when people contact us on the Carpcast, you know, saying how our Carpcast has actually influenced and inspired those to get the rods out, or we've helped them in some way. So it makes it all worthwhile.
It certainly does. Yeah, it's you know, you get a warm little glow, don't you? And you get one of them messages, or you get one of them messages like somebody's sick, they're in hospital, and they've recorded all the Carpcast for the dad to listen to while he gets better, or something like that. And yeah, it's always nice, heartwarming thing. So yeah, maybe we do our bit inspiring people. We do get plenty of messages, don't we, saying that, like, they picked up more from the Carpcast than they have in 10 years of reading magazines. And not because there isn't good content in magazines, there is, but it's the way it's digested when it's audio. Yes. You know, you listen to somebody explain it better than maybe it comes across in the written word and stuff. And I agree. I mean, I got bored of magazines quite early on, you know, in my fishing career. And you know, the I listen to podcasts for everything. They're the future. But hearing somebody tell you the story themselves, rather than, you know, like, you know, you don't have to imagine their voice when they're writing something, and things don't.
I don't think it is, just that bit more personal.
Definitely, definitely. So we hope this this episode has inspired you, and we'll see you very soon with the next episode of the Carpcast Extra. Look at me. Look at me. Look at me. Turn on. Look at me. Look at me. Look at me.
Thank you.